Dana?
All right, good afternoon. So I am, for the next half hour, going to discuss gender identity, biological sex. Are they synonymous? So first we need to identify some language that is around this issue. So when we talk about biological sex, there is inherently a binary idea infused within biological sex, because we aren't talking about a third, a fourth, a fifth, a gamete. So there is some division in having a binary understanding of reproduction itself. However, if we were to take all that there is within humanity and we were to graph that on a graph, biology is messy. And we end up with this middle area that is more purple between what we consider to be boy and girl. And so these are manifested in different ways. Gender identity, that's how an individual feels themselves to be, either masculine, feminine, as a boy, as a girl. The gender expression, how is that expressed through clothing, through hairstyle, through mannerism? And then also gender roles. What roles in society do individuals take on? So we consider this to be along a spectrum, and this is well documented within biological sciences as well as in the social sciences. So when we talk about gender, we're thinking along a spectrum, not in the binary. So just some terminology around this. Again, within the medical literature, the spectrum idea is well documented, the plasticity of sex. So the biological sex being dichotomous and binary has to do with the reproductive act itself of making a new individual. So the gametes, those sexual traits, are binary. But as individuals, an individual can encompass both traits. So this is where we get diversity or differences in the sexual development, or what we like to say within the medical literature is DSD. So that is the terminology that I will be using here. From the medical aspect is DSD. But I also want to use the word genderqueer. So the DSD community has recaptured and reclaimed the word queer. And for some in the room, in a certain generation, that word sometimes has a bad connotation. So I want to wipe that aside and just think of genderqueer as being anyone who falls within that purple area on the spectrum. So the identity expression roles is part of gender. Two other terms that we use within the aspect of both medicine and in the social sciences is cisgender or transgender. Cisgender is the vast majority of the population. A cisgender individual has no incongruence between their identity of what they think of themselves and their biological reproductive traits. A transgender individual has an incongruence there, where their reproductive biological body does not align with their identity. And then we also have non-binary intersex individuals who incorporate both types of traits. And then also in the literature, we're starting to see, in addition to gender dysphoria, which it is a problem where there's some suffering or some challenges with this dysphoria, there's also in the literature the word euphoria. And the euphoria is taking that dysphoria, the negative connotation of that, and making a more positive spin to it. So there are many aspects of gender that we can look at. Social, very connected to religion, as well as the biological sciences and the medicine. And so we have all of this information that is a century old, even into antiquities, of through the science and humanities, that is pointing in the direction of the fact that as humans, we are along a spectrum, that we are not binary, that we are very diverse. The binary idea is wrapped up in some of the theology that we consider. And so we have this hierarchy, and you'll notice as, you know, God over the church, over males, over females, and if you look down at the very bottom are the children. So the voices of those individuals within the hierarchy, I mention that because there's an implication to this when we get to the medicine, and whose voices do we listen to? So it's looking at whether philosophically we think of humanity as being either binary or along a spectrum. So social paradigm shifts. Most of you are familiar with the fact that back in the 1910, 1920s, women had specific roles in society. And then after World War II, women went into the workplace. When men came back from war, women did no longer wanted to just be at home. So we had this paradigm shift in the gender roles. And then fast forward to the 1970s, 1980s, we had a lot of genderqueer individuals. And so even gender expression became something of a change in the paradigm shift socially. So we had the Lavender Scare, if you're not familiar. This was a period of time where queer individuals were sought after. There was the Stonewall Riots that happened, where police were harassing, essentially, queer individuals. So that happened in the late 70s, early 80s. We had an activist, Marsha P. Johnson, is one of the first transgender individuals in history that we think of when we think of making a change, a paradigm shift in the social aspect of humanity. Boy George, 1980s, all the way up to James Charles right now is a YouTuber that's well known among the younger generation. And then if we even think about a paradigm shift in the digital age, that nowadays young generation can have an avatar that is more fluid, that is more malleable. And so the male-female roles and expression and gender is more, even more along that spectrum than in a binary. So we have this gender phenomenon that's happening right now. And there's both the social aspect of that and the medical aspect of it. And so for the social aspect, these individuals are just more visible now. They no longer want to be, for a better term, in the closet. So they're more, they are more honest about who they are. And about 10% of the population, and this figure is hard to narrow down because there's a lot of papers out there, but if you look, about 10% of the population would say that they're genderqueer, but they aren't necessarily going to go and have any alterations on their body. For those who have an incongruence that is significant and they decide that they want to have the autonomy to have alterations done, that percentage is about 0.06 of the population. So it's a small percentage that will go down the road of making a physical change on their body, but it's still a lot of people if we look at the full population and the percentage. So this visibility paradox that I call it is that as a society, we are more comfortable with an individual who either looks male or looks female, yet there is the attempt right now to minimize the aspect of the gender-affirming care that is out there for individuals so that they can pass, is what we call it. And so there's this paradox that they're more visible, but because they're more visible, they're more targeted as the DSD community. So one of the things that's talked a lot about is the gender-bred person, which was developed by an individual, Sam Kellerman. And he's actually a cisgender, heterosexual man, but he's a graphic designer. And he had helped with New York putting together a graphic design for an all-gender bathroom placard for New York City. And he recognized from being in college that we have all of this science about gender, but not really a way to communicate that. So that is where the genderbread person came into being, where it talks about the expression, the biological sex, and the gender roles. And so that genderbread person was rolled out in 2011. He did a talk in 2013, a TED Talk. If you go to the website there, you can get to that TED Talk. And he also did an interview with Katie Couric in 2017. So this is where that curriculum comes in, that around fourth grade, the genderbread person is introduced. There's been a backlash on that, and individuals who have asked that that curriculum not be included in the schools. So we have a ban on education, a ban on books, and now it's moving into a ban on the healthcare itself, as well as the bathroom bans. So there's levels of clarity to come to an understanding of what gender is and what the DSD community is all about. And so I've highlighted here that there's three different levels of understanding, and that the level one is looking at just social media, what some of the pundits are saying about this, but it's not much that it's not connected to the actual science that's out there. The depth and breadth of science that is out there is not typically what you're going to get when you look at just social media and some of the commentary. So level two brings it to the position where you have some of the science being talked about, but not all of the science. And if we only have a portion of the science talked about, you don't have a clearer picture. And so it's limited in its discourse. So level three is to that point where, and usually in the level three, there is a vested interest. So it may be researchers or the practitioners that are working with this community are at that level three, where they're looking at all of the science that is out there. So when you think about binary versus that spectrum idea, at the level three, spending time understanding what the science is saying, typically there's an understanding of having that spectrum idea. And that's a foundational to even understanding the DSD community. So there is a disinformation campaign that is happening using fear rhetoric, and I'll get into this through some myths, even attacking the researchers. Social mockery is huge right now in the social media. And then pointing to authority that may not have the credentials to speak to this. So gender-affirming care specifically is affirmative counseling, hormone replacement therapy, and then surgery. Those are the three components to the gender-affirming care. And there is a document that is put together by the World Professional Association for Transgender Health that was created back in the 70s. It's had many iterations and updates. It was just updated a year ago. And so that is the standard operating procedures, essentially, for healthcare that the practitioners go to. And most of the critique that comes about on gender-affirming care is more a social critique. So having a medical critique on what is happening is certainly warranted, that we need to have caution when we are implementing any of this gender-affirming care. But I would submit to you that most of the critique out there is more on the social aspect for that binary idea or maintaining a binary understanding of humanity rather than along a spectrum. So the next several slides are going to be, it would be impossible in a half an hour to do a good overview on the depth and breadth of science that's related to gender-affirming care, but I can address some of the myths that are out there that comes from that level one of not really digging into the journal articles and the science that's out there, both in medicine, in biology, in the social sciences. So the number one myth is there's no such thing. Gender identity is just an ideology, and this is definitely a myth. We have enough documentation, even into the antiquities, that gender incongruence is a thing, that it is truth. And so the evidence-based healthcare that has been provided over the decades for this community is also well documented. There's efficacy within the therapy, the hormones, and the surgery, and that increased quality of life for this population. And one way to do that is to look at the actual community and listen to them by reading their memoirs, their autobiographies, social sciences. That last one there is written by a social scientist who spent 5 years with some families that had some gender incongruent children. This first one here I'll point out because our plenary speaker, Megan DeFranca, is going to be giving a talk on Monday on intersex, the male, female, and intersex in the image of God. And then I also will point out Austin Hartke is a theologian and a transgender man. And he has written a book that is well done that speaks to the experiences that he has had and then connecting that to the theology. So this is just an example. There's many, many more resources that could be looked at to learn about this community. The other myth, they're too young to know. And I'll mention that graphic that showed kids in a very small, essentially that kids don't understand themselves who they are because they're too young to know that. And we have learned that that's not the case, which is why we now address it in younger children. And so there was a book that was written by Jillian Gill Peterson where she discusses this. She actually went to the medical literature all the way back to the early 1900s and has documented that even in a century ago that we had documentation in the medical literature of this population. So that sense of gender emerges in a transgender individual just as it does in a cisgender individual. And it's similar to their cisgender peers. And both early and late onset gender dysphoria happens because some children recognize at a very young age, whereas others that don't have the language around this. And when puberty hits, the dysphoria becomes more intense. And so that's the late onset gender dysphoria. Myth number three, we're mutilating bodies, young bodies. This is sensationalized language in social media. In young children, there's just a social transition. A child as young as four can say, "Mom, you know I am a boy," to the point that there is some challenges for the individual. And so we now, conventional wisdom is to listen to that child and where that child is. So social transition only. Puberty blockers and hormones as adolescents will slow down the development of the body so that the mind can catch up and that the decisions can be more structured and deliberate. And then surgery in late teens into adulthood. Another myth is 80% will desist. So this particular percentage has been pulled from a couple of papers. It's somewhat outdated and it's data mining. It doesn't, again, take a look at all of the literature that is out there. And when you look at all of the literature, and I've offered some here, the regret rate is actually fairly low. There's a greater awareness of this, both from the families, the practitioners, and the children themselves. The suicidality decreases through gender-affirming care. And one of the reasons that the intervention is starting out earlier is because the body going through a puberty that is does not align with the brain or their identity, it's more difficult and more invasive to do those changes later. So there's time to take a look during those teen years to see where the individual really is before making a decision on the hormones and the surgery. Puberty blockers are dangerous. This is being re-looked at, actually, in the literature, but the puberty blockers that are on the market have been used for precocious puberty since 1980s, for gender-affirming care since the 90s, and the benefits outweigh the risks, at least right now. It's still being looked at in the literature. We're watching it carefully. Explosion in detransitions. We do hear about detransitioners more now. And every story of a detransitioner is heartbreaking, granted. But when you look at the actual literature and you're talking to all of the population, the number is around 95 to 98% are satisfied with the outcome that they have. And so that decreased anxiety and the suicide ideation is decreased. Social contagion, this is a big one. There's been a little bit of research that's been done recently that talks about social contagion, that this is just a made-up thing and it's brand new. It's not brand new. Causation evidence is poor for this science. And there's two aspects of the, there's both the nature and the nurture that's involved in this. And they're both practically yelling at the individuals who are dealing with a gender incongruence. So you have the gender critical who say it's all about biological sex, it's all about our biology, and then you have the other side that's saying it's just a social construct. And it significantly is more in the middle. It's a little bit of both. So I want to dig a little bit deeper into the social contagion, because this was a paper that was just published this year. And I want to highlight that the tool that was used to recruit individuals as part of this study, I have it presented here on the graphic, just as it was presented to individuals. And if you read that quote, contemplate whether they are measuring the medical aspect of this particular DSD condition, or are they measuring the social aspect? And I've bolded those words that I feel are sensationalized in trying to get recruitment. This is a new phenomenon, this so-called gender clinics. They are not forthcoming, so there's the fear rhetoric. The task is left up to us. So if your child was normal and suddenly they're not normal anymore, can you please be part of this study? So this paper actually is now in review, and I won't go, I don't have time to go into why, but so that is it measuring a social contagion, or are we measuring a paradigm shift in what people think about what gender is? Myth number eight, it's just activism. And to put it into a narrative that it's culture wars, this is just activism, that's a way to dismiss this population. And so when you think about epistemology and how knowledge is built, from what perspective? Do we listen to the community itself or not? And so what's been happening over the last 30 years is the medical community is now listening to the population itself in designing what the healthcare should be. So that has been a shift. And that's all wrapped up in power structures even. And that's the social science side of it. Be afraid. Transgender men are boogeymen in the bathroom. And transgender females are the boogeymen in the bathroom. And transgender men are selfish because they don't want to have babies. This population is just different. They're not damaged, and they suffer, and the healthcare that is provided now provides them some relief. So I will introduce you to two transgender individuals who have become activists just because they have to. They wish that they were not. Kai Shapley, if you look up, there's a documentary, Trans in America, Texas Strong. You can look that up online. And then Changing the Game, Mac Beggs is a transgender male as a wrestler who was forced to wrestle girls during high school. Myth number 10, prohibition in the Bible. Well, the Bible would have no reason to have gender-affirming care addressed in it because we did not know what we know today with respect to gender. So, but there are positive references to eunuchs, which fall within that purple area on the spectrum, and then loving them from their perspective as a Christian response is something to contemplate. Just a couple more slides here. The language can be used in hegemony as a power structure over another group of individuals that have been labeled as others. The big one is that biological sex. That is even being codified in legislation right now. Biological sex is binary. So anyone who falls in between the boy or girl does not get accommodation. And so it's a way to dehumanize individuals, to dehumanize this population. And so to sum up, my talk really was about recognizing diversity within humanity with respect to gender. And what are the medical benefits of that? I could not go into detail, but I have a lot of references that I can offer. And then what is that loving response? If we think about the individuals themselves, their caregivers, their researchers, the practitioners that work with them themselves within that bubble, they understand this better than those on the outside of that bubble looking in. So that clarity level 3, I offer to you if you want additional information. I have a large library of journal articles that I'd be willing to share with you, books, scientific journal articles. I have connections to researchers, caregivers. And so it really comes down to, is humanity that binary boy, girl, or is it in between those individuals in that purple area? Do we accommodate them as Christians? And thank you very much. I can entertain any questions.
Okay, I got a comment and a question on your thing about being too young to know. Uh-huh. You know, brain research, one of the major things in brain development of the last probably 10 years is the fact that the brain doesn't completely develop until the early 20s, which has big implications for like capital punishment or life sentences for someone who might commit murder, you know, impulsively at the age of 18, 19, or even 20. And so we're talking maybe 25 is a cutoff.
Well, yeah, I've absolutely.
Some of these researchers. So, you know, when you say that a 4-year-old or a pre-puberty person, you know, is at the point where they can really responsibly be correct, their brain is ready to say they're a different gender. And really, you're fighting the research. I mean, you're going the wrong direction. I mean, I think slowing down any kind of medical stuff, you know, based on that, I think is, that would really be prudent. I think, you know, a lot of European countries have backed off a lot of this because there's been a lot of people regretting it. I have some good economist articles. That's a European kind of conservative thing. They have had some good references there. I'll send you on some of the issues.
I like your issues, but let's answer the one. I think one of the questions is, what about the last part? The last question, the last issue was the
gender identity. The issue is the body going through puberty happens much earlier than age 25. So this particular area of research would be called in its infancy because we're still looking at that. However, the children who have socially transitioned and even medically transitioned are very happy with the decisions that they've made, even as adults, as they reach age 25.
There's been a great increase in this over the last, say, 5 years.
Yeah.
Tremendous increase, even like in our local high school, the number of people were saying, you know, they're trans and so on. And so we don't have the long-term data, is really what I'd say. Sure, there have been cases, you know, I heard the ASA meeting, one in California about 10 years ago, one of the very first cases to ever transition. But so it's been going on for a long time, but not in large numbers.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yeah, let me cut off. Dana, address the European. Why is the Europeans backing off? Why are they no longer doing it?
So the Europeans are slowing and being more cautious. They are not ending the gender-affirming care.
I think one or
just
two countries have. I'll send you the reference.
Yeah, I've looked at the references. They are not ending the gender-affirming care. They are slowing it down. They are being more cautious, just as we are in America. But they are not ending the gender-affirming care.
I'm just reading Helen Joyce's book, Trans, The Ideology Meets Reality. And just the way you talk about science in a monolithic sense, from reading that book, it tells me that like there's a lot of different sciences going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess relating to this last comment, she says that the puberty blockers are a way of slowing down puberty to see if they persist. But the problem is that puberty is what leads to desisting. So it's a bit of a circular thing going on there, that you're delaying something that would change how they perceive themselves. And at the meantime, you're sterilizing them.
Right. And I appreciate that argument. However, children at a very young age know what gender they are. At a very young age, just as cisgender individuals do. And so following that is why there is a watch and wait procedure to see where the child goes. And if they are insistent, persistent, and consistent, and oftentimes very strongly, then that individual most likely is transgender. And so the way that you frame the question that you ask is that there's something wrong with the transition body, that we have to avoid a transition body at all cost. If it provides the individual some clarity and some alleviating some of their suffering, why having that modification? Why is that an issue? So it's two different ways of coming at this. So the puberty blocker slows it down so that the individual can think more on this. And then most individuals who have gotten to the point of doing the puberty blockers, they're already pretty set in who they are. They know who they are at a very young age. And I think that's part of what society struggles with, that we don't believe that. And the science is very clear that they do. They know who they are at a very young age.
Be careful with the science is very clear.
Yeah, that's true. Thank you for that.
Thank you for giving us a very great presentation. Thank you.
Oh, please.
A book that I read was As a Woman. Have you read that book?
And I have not.
It's a biography about an evangelical pastor who lived in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Having a friend whose husband transitioned and they're still married but have three children.
Yeah.
Listening to people's stories, knowing people, confronting people is where it's at.
Right.
I agree. That's all.
Yes.
Dana, what do you say to the person who quotes the passage in Genesis 1, male and female, God created them?
God created day and night, but he also created dusk and dawn, and that's not in that passage either. So for me, it's a very clear, we are to offer love to an individual that is meaningful to them. That is, for me, the theology is very simple.
I have to say that I probably disagree with most of everything you said.
Sorry.
And it's interesting that they traded me for this talk because I couldn't do a Monday morning chair session. I have to agree with you that there's nothing that makes me more mad than bullies on bullying transgenders and causing that is something that all Christians, we ought to be against that. And I hope everyone in this room can agree with that. And each person who is experiencing transgender or transgender iteration, that we can feel empathy towards them. Now you have to hear my side of the story, or my I have a personal anecdote. My oldest son, who diagnosed, who helped recruit him to go to Wheaton. 4 years, great time at Wheaton, graduated, takes after his mother with honors, and a double triple major, and was a swimmer, married his sweetheart, also a double major at Wheaton, honors graduate, goes and does his PhD with Fritz Schaefer, wonderful Christian mentor, if you know Fritz Schaefer at the University of Georgia. And his wife does a master's in theology and is in the PhD program in the Testament at Emory. And 2019, so they're married 10 years, no children yet, but they're busy. And he is having his, they're out in California. They're both having some, they're not talking to us about it. We take everyone to Galapagos for a family vacation. And that's, I think, December of 2019. And then we get a letter that he's moving to California. He's going to go work at Google and make Google money. But he is going to transition to be a female. abandons his wife, abandons the vows that he made in marriage, and completely rejects the faith. So I've been struggling with this for a long time, and you know what happens? Today is actually her birthday, or she would like to say, or he would like to say. And he has a girlfriend, a transgender female. He's 6'2", and she's little. And they have their eggs and sperm set aside. And it's cut off his relationship with me as well. I mean, I've looked at the science very deeply too, and I won't try to get into an argument about that, but Swiss study, best study, longest study, suicide ideation may be decreased, but suicide itself doesn't. And as we in cardiology say, death is an endpoint that's a definite endpoint. If you haven't cut down on suicide rate among those who were successfully transitioned.
But we can share the different resources and the papers that you're talking about. The papers that I have looked at show that the suicide ideation goes down and the suicides go down when there is affirmation, when the individual...
Society, and that's why people are so set in our culture to make laws that you cannot... because they feel like if we've got to regulate, and I keep that up, because if we don't have society accepting this, then we're going to not lower the suicide rate. And that, you have to say, is it possible that this condition itself may have a higher... No, it's not because of that. It's because people don't accept it.
And that's because that's what the literature is showing. And I can share the meta-analyses that show that.
The data that we have, of course, where's the randomized controlled trial? Mm-hmm. It's not there. You won't be able to do it. There's some things you can't randomize. You can't randomize this because, hey, I got the one that stays a male. You know, you can't randomize it. So... you're going to rely upon these studies. I can tell you anecdotally from several of the urologists and other people that I've talked to. Let me tell you, I did a lot of early studies with registries and percutaneous coronary interventions. I enjoyed seeing my patients back. They were happy. Their chest pains were gone. I mean, it was something I did. These urologists, they're not happy with their work. The other problem is resources. The medical resources that are done to this are not, we can't use it to take care of poor people. We're going to have people who tied up with this. And then it's a public resource, too. Think of that, too. People are going to get Medicare.
Are you reading or are you lecturing?
Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm going to shut up. But I can tell you that there is...
No.
All right.
Let's take another question.
Yes. I took this side. Let's go to this side.
Dana, hey, can you go back to the very first draft you had? It didn't look like it was scientific. It looked like more of that very first one there. It says the blue and the... yellow, pretty blue, and then pink and purple.
This one?
Yes. Is there a scientific research that shows that graph? Because I took the gay and lesbian alliance against defamation data and graphed it, and you'll see it's a very binary. I mean, you see two big peaks, and you see very little in the middle. So I'm just wondering, because it kind of seems to me that this graph is showing bias.
So
as it's showing a more convergence of what actually showed that I graphed.
This graphic is more for social purposes. If you go to the actual medical literature, they talk more about the spectrum. So it's the graphic is a way for us to visualize that there's people in this purple area.
Right.
And there really is people in the purple area.
When you look at the data, the purple area is actually very small. It's not that big.
Right, because we're talking 0.06% of the population if you're thinking transgender. So
I would
agree with that. So you agree with the spectrum, and they used to use the word continuum. And in biology, when we look at a continuum, we talk about the skin color versus. And you're going to see this kind of curve, you know, just with the big in the middle. And we don't see that with gender identity. We see the bimodal, I mean, in the majority of it. It's just this very small portion of the population. Right. I totally agree with loving these people. I don't have any problem with that. But it just seems like sometimes there's also agenda in the way the terms that are being used and like some of the graphics and stuff in the way they're trying to propose.
Right. Well, that's why I used this graphic here to show that we are seeing a paradigm shift. So that first graphic was just a way to visualize that there's these individuals who don't fall into the binary. So it's exaggerated, but it's truth.
Well, the data that I used was looking over the age groups, so it was just showing the same thing. And yeah, there was a little bit more in the younger groups, but you still saw that same binary, but just very...
Right, because for reproduction, you need a male and a female gamete. So that makes sense. Yeah.
All right, over here.
I had a question on slide 3 about definition. Cisgender is identified as non-conforming. Is that correct?
No, cisgender is just a way to denote someone who does not have an incongruence between their identity and their genitals.
The bullet on the right does not conform to the bullet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was just a list of terminology to help with, because one of the ways that hegemony is being used is individuals who refuse to use the word cisgender because they don't want to recognize that transgender people exist. And so I was just giving that as the terminology that's around this topic.
I think, Dana, something else we totally agree on is that people's roles in society, the husband who stays home because his wife has a better job and then somebody who's with the kids, I think all that kind of stuff as Christians we should affirm. You know, the idea that you don't have to be a male and have to go out and work. Yes, in the back.
I was just going to ask, because I see the power of an anecdote, but we are scientists,
right,
and we know that sometimes an anecdote doesn't represent the science. So you're the expert in the room on this, and I wondered, I came in a little late than you might have said, but I wondered if you talked about the brain development differences between trans individuals and...
We didn't have time in this particular talk to get into the specific sciences. So this was just a broad brush look at, but that is out there. They've looked at the brain development in the two, and it's beyond this talk.
Yeah, right.
Is there any effort in this whole gender-affirming care, a sentence that you really can't gender transfer, you can change some things externally, you can change the body physically, but you can't transfer. Is that ever brought up?
It is discussed. So if you have an incongruence between your identity and your body, to bring those into alignment so that that there's not that incongruence which causes them pain, you can either change the brain through the counseling that's done, which really is called conversion therapy that's being banned now for various reasons, or you can change the body. And so in early years of gender-affirming care, it was, let's change the mind, let's change that identity to align with where their body is at. And the literature is showing that that has caused trauma to individuals for doing that, which is now why we change the body, which is a cosmetic procedure for the most part. But because people in society right now are wrapped up with particularly genitals, we're talking about the reproductive body. So to get a chest reduction on a trans man is uncomfortable for a lot of people. But for the trans man, it provides them relief. And so, and even when we're talking about genitals, the surgical techniques right now have been around for decades, and there's a lot of success in it. And it's that depth and breadth of science that's typically not looked at because we are in the space of arguing about it socially, not medically. And again, I have a lot of resources. I can provide a list of the in fact, I wanted to bring a book today that was about the surgeries, but it wasn't appropriate to bring to an audience because there are pictures of genitals in it. But these techniques have been around for a long time and they've been successful.
So the technique to remove, but never to implant.
They have the ability now to build genitals. Yes.
Exactly.
Yes. Again, I wanted to bring a book that was published in 2015 and felt that it was inappropriate to have at this conference.
So let's get Brian involved a little bit. Brian and Dana both. So my son has an X chromosome in every one of his, Y chromosome in every one of his cells. Should we have a way of knocking that out? Is that appropriate use of genetic therapy? Would that help?
Why would you?
Would it help, Dana?
Why would you knock out a gene in the cells of the body?
So they only have an X chromosome. So you wouldn't have to have that Y chromosome that's just making them feel bad or it may be contributing some problems. Should we research that? Throw in another X so he has two X's in there.
Next question.
Okay. I'm not going to do it. All right. Dennis.
Yes, in that European situation which was commented on before, I'm sure you know about the Tavistock Clinic in London.
Yes,
which was promotion of transitioning in the UK context. So that was closed down recently and there was a big report about it. One of the interesting, well, I think, sort of concerning bits of data that came out of that, was that out of the total number of kids that were being counseled and helped, as a result of that clinic, one third of them were on the autism spectrum. And I just wondered whether, in your experience in the counseling and help that people get, whether they get sufficient counseling from the psychiatrists and other people who can really assess to what degree is this part of some other mental challenges that these kids are going through.
Yes.
And that came through very clearly.
Right.
Yes. Thank you for that question, because that is a medical question. And I think that it is something that the medical community is looking at, the autism and what the connections are. It's not clear in the literature where those connections are. But again, we continue to look at the gender affirming care that's being offered and what is the outcome of that. And because providing care to young people is fairly new, there's a lot of questions that are surrounding that. And we can have a conversation after this about this, the Tavistock, because there are other complications that were involved in the closing of that. And so it's too complicated to get into right now. But the literature is the long-term studies are beginning right now to show the efficacy of using the healthcare in young people. Again, because if you go through a puberty that's not appropriate for your identity, to do that later in life, we have 60-year-olds, it was mentioned here, 60-year-olds who are now transitioning because all of their life they have struggled with this. Their stories matter. And so they now make a change at a very late age, which is much harder to do. You're established as a particular gender. You might be married. There are, implications to that, which is why we're looking at having changes done when individuals are young so they can start their life out in the gender that their identity is in. That makes sense. Yeah, in the back.
I have a son who is on the autism spectrum, and he is part of a study of it's called SPARC for autism research, and it's international. It's huge, and one of the things that they have discovered is that there is a much greater possibility incidence of queer identity.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Among children, among people who are on the spectrum.
Right.
Which to me is very fascinating as somebody who studied psychology as a young person. And I think, again, like you say, these people know who they are. They want to be seen for who they know they are.
Okay.
And when they run into folks who will not accept that, they are devastated. They think they are unacceptable.
Right.
And that is nothing but harmful.
Yeah, that's where the trauma comes in.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. So do we address that in society and look towards, especially from a Christian perspective, look for resources and ways to help the individuals who are different, not damaged, and how can we help them? And again, keep in mind that 10% of the population that I threw out there, they view themselves as being genderqueer, but they aren't doing anything physically to their body. It's just how they, right? So it's a very small percentage that get to that point of having surgery done. And yes, we've seen an increase, but that's because the visibility, the understanding socially is more now than it was 30 years ago. So people are more familiar with these techniques of being able to bring closure to a problem that an individual is having that they don't want to wait into adulthood to take care of. And so those body changes that are happening, for the most part, people are satisfied with what, again, cosmetically that they're doing to their body. And they want the autonomy to do that. The caregivers as families want the autonomy to make those decisions for their children. And those decisions right now are being challenged.
Yeah.
I guess I have a question just out of curiosity. Would you be able to highlight how gender emerges in individuals? Like, I guess I'm imagining certain older parents and parents-in-law that bring up like tomboys and so on.
Right.
As like counterexamples.
Yeah, one of the things that...
I'm just curious how gender emerges in an individual.
Right.
I don't know much about that.
One of the things that we see a lot happen is that families will say, well, I had a tomboy as a child, so my child was transgender, and they grew out of it. We didn't necessarily have a transgender child. You had a child that was nonconforming. There's a difference there. And so a lot of work has been done on child development and gender. And so we know that gender emerges around age 3-4 years old. And again, the cisgender child, that procedure is the same as a transgender child. There has been work done on that. With respect to how that happens, it's beyond this talk, but I do have some papers that I can share with you if you want to give me an email. Yeah.
Let's see. I think you're first.
Okay. I think we have agreement that it's very uncomfortable and difficult to have a self-identity that's different from your body. And that's why there's all the effort for genetic surgery, well, not genetic, but just surgery and hormone therapy and the rest, mm-hmm. to try to bring a reconciliation between the two.
Right.
An honest question from right here in Toronto. At SickKids, as many children's hospitals, we have a large ward devoted to caring for anorexics. Mm-hmm. And the particular stress they're feeling is that they... are desperate for diet drugs and help because they're so fat, mm-hmm. when actually they're starving to death.
Right.
And we do conversion therapy. Mm-hmm. We try to help them compassionately realize that their bodies are actually starving, mm-hmm. and that what they need to change is their self-image.
Right.
Just how do you distinguish that from the dysphoria situation?
Right. It's a very valid question. And I would submit that the gender identity is moving an individual into a realm that is in existence. So being a masculine individual or a male, that exists just as much as being a female. So in anorexia nervosa, what they're doing is actually starving themselves, and that is not helpful to them. And so we use techniques to help them in a way that is promotes health. For gender dysphoria, when we deny an individual the changes to their body, the suicide ideation goes up, and it is alleviated once we identify that this individual, that gender identity is a real thing. So your question comes from the perspective that gender identity is not a real thing. And we have it well established in the literature and antiquities that identity incongruence is something that has been with humanity for a long time. And so now we're using techniques to help the body align with what the identity is saying.
Right, I'm just suggesting that I see it so clearly in anorexics. Their identity, they know they are horribly fat.
Right.
So, I mean, the experience is real.
The experience is
real. I'm just talking about which way do we move to get the congruity.
Right. Well, we've tried the mental way of counseling. And we've tried the conversion therapy, and that has been shown in the literature to be harmful to the individuals, which is now, you know, 50 years ago, the switch has happened where we're listening to those individuals, we're making changes in their body, and they're happy with the changes. It's a cosmetic. That's the other thing, is because it's genitals, society has somewhat of an issue with it. So to remove breast tissue can be uncomfortable for most people, but for the individual that's having that surgery, they experience euphoria. Do we deny them that euphoria because that's their experience that's different than ours? So that's where the social and the medical and the biological, it's messy. But in the last 30 years, the conventional wisdom is to listen to the community and what they want, and they're happy with those changes.
I want to be really careful about what the science says or the conventional wisdom.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I spend a fair amount of time working in the medical system in Stockholm. And the Karolinska Institute, which brought us Christine Jorgensen 80 years ago, refuses to do hormone blockers or hormone therapy or surgery under 18. Mm-hmm. They don't think there is a consensus that the science is clear. So just, there's a lot there to think about.
Right, right.
Okay,
and
we're
that's
getting
fair.
To the end of the hour. For those of you who want to read The Counter, there is a wonderful review book by Paul Edward McHugh, who was the former head of the program at Johns Hopkins, which was doing some of the early transitions. They stopped for a while. They're back doing it now. He's also in the Academy of Science. I've talked to him about this whole issue, but he has an excellent book review that he did. It's published online. You can get to it. Paul Edward McHugh. Paul McHugh. All right. I'm sorry. Our time is up. It's been very exciting. And honestly, I think there is a lot we can agree with, though, in terms of treating people compassionately, listening. But people are hurt both sides. I've been deeply hurt by this issue.